It is time, dear students, to now look backwards. Chapter 11, Diversification and Risky Asset Allocation. In this chapter, we try to tie everything that we've learned together. Now, I had a professor once who completely confused the entire class with various different pieces of whatever we were studying, and then at the very end he said, well, now we're going to tie it all together and hopefully it all makes sense. And after he was done, we were still completely befuddled, so I apologize if you get that feeling after this. But we've come full circle, folks. We started with what is an investment and looked at some characteristics of investments and the risk return profile of each. And so we concentrated on short-term investments and mutual funds and stocks and bonds. And so now we're going to try to take a look at the bigger picture with diversification and risky asset allocation. Asset allocation. And really, folks, what are we talking about? Slide number 2. Spreading your investments across a number of asset classes to eliminate some, but not all, the risks of investing. Because it doesn't matter what you invest in, every investment has some risks. So what do? We try to reduce that risk by spreading it around. That's why we use the term diversification. And it's an old, old saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket, right? Well, there are some people, Mark Twain is supposed to have said this, and of course you have to be careful whenever someone says Mark Twain said it, because it's often, I mean, he said a lot of great things, don't get me wrong, but a lot of times it's where somebody else has said it. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. No. Put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket. Well, I don't know if I necessarily agree, because you can be watching that basket fall and crash. So diversification helps us not put all our eggs in one basket. And it guarantees, folks, that something every year that we invest in will make us sad. Yeah, but it also increases the odds that something will make us very, very happy, right? Exactly. Slide number 3. Here is a list of major asset classes. Going back 25 years, large company United States stocks, global small company stocks, international stocks outside the United States, emerging market stocks, United States bonds, international bonds, and cash. And what you notice is that there are some times when one asset class goes on a multi-year run. Notice emerging market stocks. But notice how also, one drop of 50% kills, everything you had in half. But you'll also notice that there's sometimes bonds do better than stocks. Sometimes the end of the 90s was very, very popular time for United States large companies. But the one thing I hope you take away from this is not once was cash the best performing asset. Pretty amazing, isn't it? Everyone always wants to run to the money market, run to CDs for safety. And not once in the last 25 years was it the best holding. Pretty wild. I'm a big fan right now of large company stocks here in the United States and outside the United States. Why? Because they've underperformed relative to everybody else for several years. I believe that over the next 5 to 10 years, no guarantee, that they are going to have their day again in the sunshine. But we'll see. We'll see. That's why it's called the future. And that's why we diversify. Slide number 4. We diversify to reduce risk, but how do you measure risk? Yeah. We've come full circle. Way back in chapter 1, we introduced the tug of war, the eternal struggle between risk and return. We saw how the higher the average annual return, the higher the standard deviation. and its companion measure variance from the average annual return, but we found that they're not perfect measurements of risks, folks. They don't tell you what's going to happen next year. We've studied the major financial asset classes, mutual funds, stocks, bonds, cash. We discussed the risks and the returns of each. Return is easy to measure. How much money did you start with? How much money did you end with? That's how much you made. How long did it take you to make that much? But risk is very difficult to measure. It's even harder to anticipate. Witness 2008, where everybody fell down, except for cash, which doesn't fall, and except by inflation, and U.S. Treasury bonds. Why? Because everybody rushed into Treasury bonds because they were frightened of anything else except for what the United States government was producing. Slide number five. Variance and standard deviation. Variance and its more useful companion, standard deviation, tell us how much an asset class will vary from the expected return. These measures are readily available from the investment community, folks, and the numbers ain't pretty. For any randomly selected stock on the New York Stock Exchange, the standard deviation is almost 50%. That means in any given year, many stocks on the New York Stock Exchange, these are the most stable stocks, right? The biggest, well, some on the NASDAQ now, will vary up or down close to 50% from their average annual returns. Yikes! So how can we reduce the variance, right? In other words, how can we reduce the risk? Well, of course, slide number six. The answer is to diversify. If you go from one randomly selected stock down to two randomly selected stocks, the standard deviation goes down from 49% down to 37.5%. If you go to 10 stocks, it goes down to almost 24%. 20 stocks, 22%, and so on. By diversifying our portfolio, we have reduced our risk substantially as measured by the reduced variance and the standard deviation, realizing that those are imperfect measures to begin with. Are you with me? You following me? We reduced the risk as measured by variance and standard deviation, but that's not a perfect measurement of risk. Slide number seven. Now, this chart is trying to show you as you add stocks, you reduce the risk as measured by standard deviation. Okay? That's what this is. And this is the ratio of the standard deviation to the standard deviation of a single stock. So basically, we reduced our risk by, 40% of what it was by diversifying upwards of 100 to 50 to 200 stocks. But you see what's happening as we increase the number of stocks, the number really isn't going down that much. Here is a graph of that table that we just saw. Slide number 8 is a graph of the table we just saw. And this should look familiar to you mathematicians, right? It's a limit. Right, there is a limit to which diversification can reduce your risk in any given asset class. In this case, we're talking about stocks. And why is that limit there? Why can't we reduce the risk down to zero? The answer is correlation. Correlation? Yes. Slide number 9. Correlation is the tendency of the returns of two assets to move together. Imperfect correlation is the key reason why diversification reduces portfolio risk as measured by the portfolio standard deviation. Now, let's say that again, because the first time you read it, you don't understand what it's saying. The fact that no two investments will be exactly the same is the reason that diversification works, because they are imperfectly correlated. But that doesn't mean they're not positively correlated. Many assets are positively correlated, which means they tend to move it up and down together. Not perfectly, but they are positively correlated. Negatively correlated assets tend to move in opposite directions. So go back and read this slide over again and make sure you understand it, because the words sometimes get in the way of the meaning. The meaning is no two investments are going to be exactly the same, but many investments look similar. And so let's take a look at slide number 10. And what we can compute, now we're not going to do it, it's done for us, but you can learn how to do it in statistics class, it's in the book if you want to learn. And that's the correlation coefficient. It's the measure of how closely returns on assets move together. If assets move in exactly the opposite direction, the correlation coefficient will be -1, meaning it's -100, right, -100%. If they are uncorrelated, which means they don't move, one moves one way, the other moves the other way, sometimes they move together, sometimes they don't, that would be 0% correlation. And if they're perfectly positively correlated, that would be +1 or +100%. So let's take a look at slide 11, and hopefully the pictures make it easier to understand. These two investments, A and B, great names, are positively correlated. In fact, they are perfectly positively correlated. When one goes up, the other one goes up. Now, not as much. One goes up higher than the other, but that's not important. What's important is they go up together, and they go down together, and they go back up together, and they go down together. We may say they're in sync. They're perfectly positively correlated. And in the second graph, they are perfectly negatively correlated. One goes up, the other goes down. The other one comes back up, the first one goes back down. So they have a -100% or -1 correlation. And then the third graph is trying to, but I don't think it does a good job, is trying to show that the two are completely unrelated. Zero correlation, 0%. One goes up, the other one goes down, or maybe sideways, or goes up or down, and you can't come up with any kind of correlation. So you understand the idea? Positive correlation, they move together. Negative, they move apart from one another. And no correlation, they have nothing to do with one another. Slide number 12. So how does this answer about our question about why diversification can only reduce by so much the risk of stocks? How does this answer that question? Why does correlation answer the question? Because although stocks are not perfectly correlated, they are positively correlated enough so that stocks in general tend to move in the same direction. So adding more stocks, it doesn't reduce your risk anymore because they're positively correlated. This is why we often refer to stock investments as a whole as the stock market. Even though at any given time some companies are doing well, others are doing poorly, and many are simply chugging along as they've always have done in the past. You see, that's why we can say, how's the market doing? Because stocks are positively correlated with one another. So we can't reduce the risk of stock investing to zero by diversifying. You can't. If they're correlated, some are going to go down, they're all going to go down. Excuse me. Slide 13. Darn. That's still too much risk for me. I think I'm going to stick to bonds. You are a very conservative, risk-averse investor, and remember, it doesn't have anything to do with politics. You don't like the volatility of stocks. Therefore, you decide to place all your investments into bonds. You will accept the lower return from bonds in exchange for the lower risk of the bonds. Oops, bad idea. What? Why is that a bad idea? Because, like stocks, bonds are positively correlated with themselves. They also tend to do well and tend to do poorly as a whole. And, interestingly enough, they are often negatively correlated with stocks. Stocks and bonds often, but not always, move in opposite directions. You understand? So if you're trying to reduce your risk, as measured by standard deviation, sticking all with bonds is a bad idea. Slide number 14. And now this graph, it's a little tricky for some people, but the idea is it's trying to show what happens to your return and to your standard deviation as you change the portfolio. If you're 100% invested in stocks, you're going to have the highest return over time, but you're also going to have the highest standard deviation. And as you start to add bonds and decrease the amount of stocks, you start to reduce the standard deviation. The risk goes down, but also the return goes down. Until finally you get to a point where you can't reduce the risk anymore. You're still reducing the return because you're adding more bonds, but the risk actually starts to go back up again because you've reduced all the stocks. You've gotten rid of all the stocks, and bonds are more correlated with themselves, and so that negative correlation doesn't help your risk anymore. You actually start to increase your risk, and that's what this graph is trying to show you. And if that graph doesn't do it for you, let's take a look at slide 15 where we see a table. And they should use 100% and 0%, but they don't. They use 1.00, whatever. 100, just add two zeros and make it a percentage sign. So 100% stocks, 0% bonds. We have the highest expected return. Remember, it's not guaranteed. And we also have this highest standard deviation. And as we add more bonds and subtract stocks, we see our return go down. Well, that makes sense. But we also see our standard deviation go down. That makes sense. We're reducing the risk because stocks are riskier than bonds. Until we get to a point where the risk actually bottoms out and starts to go back up as we reduce the number of stocks and add more bonds. And of course, our expected return goes down because the expected return from bonds is less than stocks. So you understand? You understand? It doesn't make sense to give up on stocks entirely. Slide number 16. A combination of stocks and bonds actually created a portfolio with less risk while earning you more than just bonds. You understand why balance funds are so popular? Yeah, and why the good balance funds stay around 50-50, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, maybe 40% stocks, 60% bonds. Because not only do you get a better return than just bonds, you get less risk than just bonds. If you are seeking less risk, it not only pays to diversify within an asset class, it pays to diversify among asset classes. This same kind of relationship occurs between within domestic and foreign stocks and bonds, although much less now than in the past. And diversification is still not a guarantee of positive results. No diversification scheme worked well for you in 2008 unless your diversification consisted of treasury bonds and cash. Because everybody fell down. Stocks, bonds, not treasury bonds, but muni bonds, corporate bonds were destroyed. Global stocks, international stocks, real estate, commodities, oil, wheat, gold, everything went down. So diversification is not a guarantee, but it helps. We have a name for choosing the appropriate mix for an investor. It is called slide number 17, asset allocation. Now you've already seen this, haven't you? Some mutual funds call themselves asset allocation funds. It's a fancy term for how much should I have in stocks, how much should I have in bonds, how much of each stock and bond type. And for many, many decades, investors suggested a formula such as subtract your age from 100. But now they're using 110 and 120. That is the percentage of stocks you should own. The rest should be in bonds. So, for example, a 40-year-old person would have 100 minus 40, or 60% in stocks, 40% in bonds. A 20-year-old would have 80% in stocks, 20% bonds, 60-year-old, you understand? Well, the problem with this is that people are living far longer. It made sense for somebody who was 60 years old to have 40% stocks, 60% bonds, because their expected lifespan from here on in was not that great. But that's all changed. People are living far longer. So many of us, including myself, say, poppycock! A 20-year-old shouldn't have any bonds, in my humble opinion. Buy high-quality stocks, put up with the risk. Once you're near retirement, start buying bonds because you need that ballast, we sometimes use the term. You need that stability. But don't give up on stocks entirely, because it used to be that people retired at 62 and died at 64. But that ain't true anymore. People are retiring at 62 and going back to work at 64 because they're bored or they got an offer they can't refuse or they just want some more money. Slide number 18. Asset allocation. Here's $100,000. How do you divvy it up? Now, folks, this is just an example. I'm not recommending this to you. I'm not recommending it to me. I'm just saying here's one example. You got $100,000. You're a little bit worried about the stock market, but you're young and you have a financial advisor, or maybe you've educated yourself to take in business 123 and you're ready to put it to work. And you say, I'll put 75% in stocks, 25% in bonds. You know, I want that little bit of stability from bonds. So within the bond category, you put $15,000 in high-yield corporate and government, you know, triple B or above. $5,000 in some high-yield, high-grade, I'm sorry. $15,000 in high-grade corporate and government, my apologies. $5,000 in high-yield non-investment grade, also called junk bonds, lower than BBB, and 5,000 foreign bonds, global bonds. And you could use mutual funds or you could buy them yourself. 75% of it, $75,000, is going to go into stocks, and we're going to put $25,000 into domestic growth and income, $25,000 into global growth and income. You know I love those growth and income mutual funds and growth and income stocks, huh? $10,000 aggressive, there's our, you know, our spice. $10,000 international and $5,000 in small company stocks. You like it? It's yours. And I'm not saying it's the end all and be all. You have to look at the person's time horizon, their risk tolerance, of course you never really know until they lose 20-30%, then you'll see what their risk tolerance is really like. But it's just one example. Slide number 19. Some of those same advisors that suggest asset allocation also suggest the technique of rebalancing. Now, I actually like this, folks. It makes a whole lot of sense. Each year, you check to see if your percentages are still in balance. So, say stocks have had a banner year, right? You set for yourself a 60-40 allocation. You might now be at 70-30 instead of your target 60-40. So what you have to do is you have to sell some stocks and buy some bonds, whether mutual funds or individual securities, to bring the balance back to your target 60-40. And if stocks have done poorly or bonds have done really well, you have to sell some bonds and buy some stocks to bring the percentage back up to 60-40. And this is wonderful. Why? It's no guarantee, but it forces you to do the right thing. If stocks are going gangbusters, who wants to sell? Who? Not me, not you. But our rebalancing technique says it's time for us to sell some of our stocks and buy some bonds. And if stocks have done poorly, it forces us to buy. We don't want to buy. Everybody's running for the cover, running for the hills. No, you need to bring your asset allocation back into balance. So you're forcing people to buy low and selling high. Now, is it a guarantee? No, it is not a guarantee. But it takes a lot of the emotion out of investing, which is, I believe, a good thing normally. Now, how about retirement? Well, many advisors suggest that retirees shed the bulk of their stock investments in favor of bonds and cash investments. We're on slide 20. The only problem is people are living much, much longer, as we mentioned. A 50-year-old today has a 50-50 chance of living to see 100 years old. That's amazing, folks. Very, very few people live to 100. And they're saying, now we don't know if we're right, or that's another 50 years from now, but if you turn 50, you have a 50-50 chance of living to 100. Scary thought. And you'll hear people say, my wife and my sister-in-law will say this, I don't want to live that long. I don't want to be stuck in, you know, in this broken body, not be able to do the things I can do now. And I say, you know, you say that now, but when you get there, it's not so bad. You know, could be worse. You millennials, 120, 130, should be the norm. Now, we don't know. It's speculation, but we're looking at current trends. We know what hurts people. We know what people have to do to live a long and healthy life. You know, you don't want to smoke. Yes, mother, you want to eat your vegetables. Stay away from that carbonated sugar water and a lot of meat. And I love cheese. But you got to keep your weight under control. You have to exercise. And with coupled with the modern technology that has infiltrated all aspects of healthcare, and you millennials should live to 140 and 50. I mean, I read one prediction that the first person who's going to live to 150 has already been born. So it's very exciting. But it's a very serious problem for people in retirement. They can't give up on stocks. They need that growth. Excuse me. As you near retirement, start migrating from your investments from stocks to bonds, but don't abandon stocks entirely. And on the website, it's not there right now. I'm going to try to wait until get the data from the end of the quarter, March 31st, 2012. But if not, I'll use January 31st. And we're going to see what happens if you retire and invest only in stocks. Kind of a scary proposition, but some people do it, depending on how much money they have and if they have, you know, a pension or something like that. If you invest entirely in bonds, or if you invest in a combination of stocks and bonds. So we're going to take a look at some illustrations. Of course, in the face-to-face class, we could do them in front of the class, which is kind of cool, and I like to do that. But if you have any others that you would like to see, as I've said in the past, you know, please send me an email, give me a call, ask for them, and I'll run them for you and post them on the website, or if you just want it for yourself. Slide 21. You remember dollar cost averaging? Our good old friend back from Chapter 4 when we looked at mutual funds? This is a system of buying an investment at regular intervals with a fixed dollar amount. Folks, as we said, we want to remove the emotions from investing, and dollar cost averaging is a wonderful way to do it. And the coolest part of dollar cost averaging, as I tell my wife, and I say Anita because that's her name, I say, no matter what happens tomorrow morning, there is good news for us when we wake up. And she rolls her eyes and says, sure, Frank. The market's up. Good news. Yippee. Because your account is now worth more. We're in the money. The market's down. Good news. Huh? What are you talking about, Payana? Are you crazy? No. Next month, you'll get more shares at a lower price when the $50 or $100 comes out of your paycheck or your checking account. You understand? You millennials, you want the market to crash. Not stay crashed, but you want it to. Why? Because you're going to be putting $50, $100, maybe more, into the market over the next 30, 40 years, 50 years. You want to buy low. You see? So you get to the point where you think, oh, you get this perverse joy when market goes down. Because you think, hey, because I'm going to buy my, you hope it happens right at the first of the month when your money comes out of your paycheck, whatever. Slide number 22. Here's an example. And we discussed this back in Chapter 4, but we didn't actually calculate it. But now we're going to calculate it. And the answers are right in front of you on slide 22. But I want you to do it. I want you to write it down and calculate it yourself to make sure you believe that this is what's going on. It's 3 years, let's say, and you're investing $1,000 per year. The first year, the share price is $10. The second year, the value is dropped in half. 2008 happens. And then the third year, it's recovered 50% from the low. So you've invested $3,000, and you see that you bought $1,000 at 10, $1,000 at 5, $1,000 at 750. And I think I got this from the Wealthy Barber. I'm pretty sure I did. I'm not sure. But you purchased 100 shares when the price was $1,000. You purchased 200 shares when the price was $5, and you purchased 133.333 shares when the price was $7.50. So although it looks as though you simply broke even because you bought at 10, you bought at 5, and you bought at $7.50, you actually made money because you bought more shares at the lower price. You see, the average cost per share is $6.92, 3,000 divided by 433.333. But the current price is $750. So you multiply that. You multiply $7.50 times $433.333 shares. My apologies. The phone rang. I apologize. And you wind up with $3,250. You actually made money. People don't believe you. They don't. You know, it's like it looks like somebody's card trick or something like that. But work it out. You understand? Work it out. And so, I want you to memorize this. I know it doesn't make sense at first, but I asked you to memorize it back in chapter 4. I'm going to ask you to memorize it again. With dollar cost averaging, your average cost per share should be less than your average price per share. Got it? Okay. Slide 23. By investing always the same amount of money, you are purchasing more shares when the price is low and fewer shares when the price is high. Here's the thing I want you to memorize and tell people, and they won't understand you, and then you'll explain it to them. Your average cost per share should be lower than your average price per share, but it is not a guarantee of success. Dollar cost averaging is not going to help a lousy investment turn a handsome profit. You understand? If it keeps going down and down and down and down, you're well. But it does make investing very easy, folks. For mutual fund investors, that is. It's a little trickier for stocks and bonds. Why? Because you have to build up, you know, $500, $600, $1,000 or more dollars before you actually buy the shares. Why? Because you don't want to buy one share at $50. You're going to pay $6, $7, $12, maybe more commissions. It doesn't make any sense. And, of course, bonds, they want, you know, thousands of dollars. So slide 24. Speaking of mutual funds, wasn't diversification one of the two main reasons why so many investors choose mutual funds? Yes, indeed. That's the big reason we buy mutual funds, for diversification. The other is professional money management, of course. But does that mean mutual funds are necessarily have less risk than are necessarily going to have less risk in individual portfolios? Well, it all depends on which mutual funds we're talking about. So your assignment is to go to Morningstar or finance.yahoo.com and enter a mutual fund such as the one I said. It doesn't matter. I have a link. I have some on the assignment sheet that I like, but you can do any mutual fund. There are, you know, thousands of these things, folks. And find the link to risk. And you're going to take a look at some measurements of risks of mutual funds and see if some mutual funds were able to reduce the risk. Some are and some aren't. Now, let's take a look at an entirely different way of looking at mutual funds, and that's from a concentration standpoint. This is a graph that shows the equity, stock and bond flows, inflows and outflows of money into and out of mutual funds over the past 25 years. And as we describe here at the bottom, many market historians have observed the tendency of mutual fund inflows and outflows to be a fairly reliable contrarian indicator of market performance. What does that mean? In other words, when people rush into stock mutual funds, it's usually not the best time. And when they rush out of stock mutual funds, that means it's usually a good time to invest in the stock market. And vice versa for bond mutual funds. When people rush out of bonds, that's usually the best time to be investing in them. And when they rush into bonds, it's not a good time. At least that's the way it's been in the past. There's no guarantee that it will continue in the future, but let's take a look at what happened here. This is 1994. And what we see is that the green is, it shows up green on my screen. I'm not sure if it's green on yours. The bond mutual funds, people jumped out of bond mutual funds in 1994, and that was after the recession of 90 to 92 or so, and the Federal Reserve Board The Federal Reserve Bank was starting to increase interest rates because the economy was coming out of the recession. And sure enough, people got spooked and jumped out of bonds at the worst possible time when the price was low. And then in the late 90s, people basically ignored bonds and then were dumping money into stocks up until 2000, where you see the stock inflows just skyrocket relative to that period of time, and bond outflows. Again, the worst time to be jumping out of, well, I wouldn't use the worst, but a bad time to be jumping out of bonds, and a really bad time to be jumping into stocks, because the next 3 years, stocks underperformed. They went from, you know, the S&P basically lost about 50% over 2.5 years. And that was the time to be going into bonds, because the next 10 years, bonds trounced stocks throughout the 2000s. And we see that equity outflows went down again in 2002, just in time for 2003 when the stock market rallied. And we see that stocks and bonds are bouncing back up and forth. But here in 2008, look at 2008, stock outflows. The stock market cratered in 2008. That was the best time to get in. And then what we see is for the last 4 years, from 2008-2011, stock outflows have been more than the inflows. There have been net redemptions from the stock market using mutual funds. And look at the bond inflows. The bond inflows have been enormous. People have been just dumping their money into bonds, and bonds have done really well. And they've beaten stocks over 10-year periods. They've beaten stocks certainly over the last few years. What does this tell us about the future? Well, you, dear student, have to come up with your own conclusion. But my conclusion, if this indicator, this contrarian indicator, continues to be reliable, that the next 10 years, 15 years, stocks should do better than bonds. It's not a guarantee. But what we see is people wholesale jumping out of stocks, jumping into bonds, and we'll see. In 2012 so far, it's been outflows for stocks. Not as much as the past few years, but there have been net outflows and net inflows into bonds. So how long it will continue, I don't know. But I believe the next 10 years are going to be, it's going to be better for stocks. Well, talk to me in 10 years. We'll see. We'll see if I'm crying or if I'm laughing. Because we're heavily invested in stocks. Now, that, dear students, is our discussion of diversification and risky asset allocation. And believe it or not, we are finished. Well, not really, no. But we've done the heavy lifting. You now know the most important retail investors for the average investor. You now know the most important. You understand the tug of war between risk and return. You understand short-term investments, mutual funds, stocks, bonds, yeah. And so what do we do for the rest of the semester? Well, relax. We're not done. We're going to take a look at some other investment alternatives that I hope you will avoid. Options and futures and margining and shorting And we'll take a quick look at real estate, commodities, and fine art, and collectibles. So don't give up on us yet. But I hope so far you have seen some investments that have piqued your interest and are ready to start making decisions on your own. See you in the next chapter when we take a look at stock options, their derivatives, they're dangerous,
You're going to lose your money. And, you know, if you like Las Vegas, hey, you'll probably like stock options.